Good afternoon, it's 3 o'clock here on a June afternoon for Monday, March 19th, the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here. Today we'll talk with Beth Weigel and Christine Moore about this Friday's Discovery Day. Tom Matisse will be discussing tonight's presentation on an urban avalanche mitigation study. Andy O'Neill Cole from AWARE will be here with a preview of Wednesday's Brown Bag session on homelessness and domestic violence. We'll also talk with Liz Perry and Linda Bilardi about planning for Celebration 2012. That writer's almanac for known music and more today on a June afternoon. Weather forecast for tonight looks like there's a strong wind warning through tomorrow afternoon. High temperatures around 40 degrees predicted for the rest of today, and low temperatures 18 to 27 degrees predicted for tonight.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Officials in an eastern Oklahoma city are putting off a routine review of building plans for a tribal casino. As Kurt Gortney with KGOU reports, this is the latest step in efforts to block the gaming center.
Officials with the city of Broken Arrow will delay their review of engineering plans for the controversial casino, partly because questions remain about whether a tribe can legally establish the facility at the proposed location. City Manager David Wooden said in a news release Friday that officials had received an application from a contractor, but they're not acting on it. The Kyalege tribal town wants to build the Red Clay Casino on land allotted to the Muscogee Creek Nation near Tulsa, Oklahoma. The Kyalegees are affiliated with the nation. According to the Tulsa World newspaper, officials say the city is awaiting the resolution of a federal lawsuit filed by Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt. His suit alleges the Kyalegees don't have jurisdiction over the property. A federal judge has scheduled a May 2nd hearing in the case. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
Recently, National Presbyterian leaders traveled to the Alaskan village of Gamble for a two-day reconciliation ceremony on St. Lawrence Island. It's located in the Bering Sea, about 165 miles northwest of Nome. KMBA's Jocelyn Estes has more.
Presbyterian church officials say early missionaries tried to stamp out the traditional Yupik culture of the people of Gamble by punishing people for speaking their native language and telling them their dances were evil. Lucia Pataki is a commissioned lay minister in Gamble and village-based counselor. She says the church's legacy harmed multiple generations of people.
I really believe they had a huge negative impact because we were humiliated and shamed.
Apataki says during the reconciliation, they heard talks on the history and effects of historical trauma, and elders described their grievances. Then church leaders asked for forgiveness and offered plaques with written apologies. She says she saw a changed attitude at a celebration held at the end of the two-day event.
It was a powerful, powerful celebration. There was a freedom in the dance and the song, and in my entire life I had never seen so many of our men dancing with such abandonment and freedom.
Apataki says she hopes the church's apology will have a positive impact on high rates of alcoholism and domestic violence, not only in Gamble, but in all of Alaska. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
The U.S. Interior Department announces millions of dollars in conservation grants have been awarded to tribes. More than $4.2 million in tribal wildlife grants will go to 23 tribes in 17 states. The grants will fund a wide range of projects from salmon restoration to invasive species control. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, tribes manage more than 100 million acres of fish and wildlife habitat across the country. One of the recipients is the Muscogee Tribe of Florida. It will be a partner in efforts to restore Everglades snail kite habitat on its reservation and surrounding lands. The tribe is also pursuing its ability to restore and enhance aquatic habitat for native fisheries. The Interior Department announced the grants last week. On this day in 1900, an executive order increased the size of the Tongue River Indian Reservation in Montana. It was renamed the Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation. Today, nearly 5,000 enrolled Northern Cheyenne tribal members live on the reservation, located in the southeastern part of the state. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Kiwanis is accepting reservations for the 17th Annual Alaska Native Art Auction. Proceeds benefit KNBA and Native Public Radio programming. Visit knba.org or call 907-793-3528 for reservations.
Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIC, CLIC, GIVE when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our first guest is Beth Weigel from Discovery Southeast. Beth, thank you very much for coming down.
Thanks, Jeff.
So you're here to talk about Discovery Day, which is coming up this next Friday, March 23rd at Eagle Crest.
That's right. It's our Discovery Day program. We do about 7 of these a year on in-service and holidays. And the Friday of spring break at Eagle Crest is one of my favorite Discovery Days that we do.
And why is that?
Well, first of all, you get to play in the snow, so we have a bunch of snowshoes, and we send off our 7 to 12-year-old participants, and there's still a few spaces left, off on a hike in the snowshoes with Tom Schwartz this year. He's one of our naturalists. We call him Tall Tom, and he certainly knows all of the best spots up at Eagle Crest. So I was talking to him just before I came on the show, and he said, oh, we might head up towards what I call the Douglas Divide, which is kind of going up towards the Black Bear Chair and into that little valley there, or they might head towards Fish Creek. So he's got a couple of great ideas. It also is my favorite Discovery Day because Rich Mattson from DIPAC, he comes up and we set up a ice cream making activity and at the end of the day. And so he teaches everybody why you can make ice cream with snow and salt and why that creates the perfect temperature for making ice cream, and everybody gets to make their own little bit of ice cream, so it's a pretty fun thing.
You bring some down here to the studio afterwards, right?
Well, I can show you how to make it at home. It's really easy. You just need a bucket and some milk and some vanilla and some ice and salt and shake it up, and you can have ice cream in 7 minutes or so.
Cool. So the people who are going to be snowshoeing, do they need any previous experience on snowshoes?
No, snowshoeing is a lot like walking. The snowshoes is just the adaptation that helps keep you above the snow. And so we have about 20 pairs of kid-sized snowshoes we can loan out. Of course, if kids have their own snowshoes, we'd encourage you to bring them. We also have some adult-sized snowshoes. So if you're interested in maybe volunteering and helping us out on Friday, give us a call at the office at 463-1500. That's also the number you can call to register your child for the program. And like I said, we still have maybe about 5 or so spaces, so we can certainly take some more kids.
And what's the admission price?
We charge $35 for our members and $40 for non-members, so get a little discount as a member. And also, if you're a member and you're up at Eagle Crest on Friday, Eagle Crest is going to give us some hot beverage cards to hand out to our members. We'll have our education display in the lodge with some furs and tracking information, because it's a great time to go tracking in the snow. You can see all kinds of cool critter tracks and try to figure out what they've been doing all winter long.
And it's just one of the many things that Discovery Southeast does. For people who don't know, could you give us a little information about Discovery Southeast?
Sure. We're a nonprofit nature education organization. We do hands-on nature education with kids, primarily in the age ranges of 6 or 7 to 12 or 13, but we do some older kid stuff as well. We do some adult programs, and we provide a lot of natural history information on our website, which is www.discoverysoutheast.org. And we also, have probably the best fundraiser around in the form of a dinner and an auction. We're having our 23rd dinner and auction fundraiser on April 7th, so we just started ticket sales, and you can get tickets from us at the office, at Hearthside, from a board member. So we like to get outside and enjoy the wonderful weather and teach kids a little bit about the nature and science all around them in their backyards.
What kind of critters are you protecting now?
Well, of course, most of the big critters, like bears, they're hibernating still, so we don't see those sorts of tracks. But you see a lot of the little voles and weasels, and I guess you call them ermines in the winter time, right? And sometimes you see some really great bird tracks. You do still see some deer tracks, probably not up at Eagle Crest, but the most fun track that I think I see up there, and you often see it when you get on the Hooter chairlift, is you see either a porcupine track trail. They sort of create a little trail because of their bodies dragging them along, or you see a snowshoe hare, and it's pretty fun to try and figure out what the snowshoe hares are about, because you hardly ever see them in actuality, but you see the evidence of them all the time.
You mentioned Discovery Southeast does a few events for adults. What are some of the events that you do that are kind of like Discovery Days for young people?
Yeah, we've had different hikes and talks that some of our naturalists do. We held a really great series of speakers in the fall, people who had been to Antarctica and done work there. We've also had some different hikes. Richard Carstensen, our longtime naturalist and a person who's probably the living historical natural history icon of our community, one of them at least. He oftentimes will take people out on a hike. And so, yeah, we like to engage our volunteers, adults through volunteer as well. So we'll have Sea Week coming up. We do the fourth grade program. So anybody who's interested in volunteering and helping us with Sea Week, we'd love to have people help out that way too.
You can find out about these things by becoming a member and getting a newsletter in the mail.
Exactly. So, yeah, we also have a great website that has lots of our program information on it. So that's, again, Discovery Southeast. It's all one word, all spelled out, .org. Or our phone number is 463-1500.
All right, Beth Weigel, talking about this Friday's Discovery Day at Eagle Crest. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
It'll just be a really fun week to be up at Eagle Crest. I encourage everybody to get up there every day, and then Friday is going to be the culmination with this Discovery Day hike and ice cream making, and should be fun.
About five more slots left for young people, so call 463-1500 right now to register.
Great. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Beth.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 19th of March, 2012. It was on this day, 1842, that Balzac's play, Les Ressources de Canola, opened at the Odeon Theater in Paris. Balzac had a brilliant idea to publicize the play by starting a rumor that the play was completely sold out. He thought people would come to see what all the excitement was about. But instead, nobody came, assuming they couldn't get tickets, and the theater was almost empty for opening night. It's the birthday of Moms Mabley, the comedian, born in Brevard, North Carolina, 1894. Her parents died in separate accidents. She was raped twice as a teenager, had two children by rape who were taken from her. She was being forced into a marriage with an older man. When she ran away, went to Cleveland, met the black vaudeville team Butterbeans and Susie, became very successful on the Chitlin circuit, earning more than $10,000 a week at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, doing raunchy humor, dressed in a frumpy dress and a floppy hat. Moms Mabley, who said, "A woman's a woman until the day she dies, but a man's only a man as long as he can." It's the birthday of the novelist Philip Roth, born Newark, New Jersey, 1933. Father was an insurance salesman, parents both children of Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe. Roth was an English teacher at the University of Chicago, where he met Saul Bellow, who told him he should keep writing. He was 26 when he published his first book, a novella and short stories titled Goodbye Columbus, and it was a big hit, won the National Book Award. He wrote two novels, which got mixed reviews, then for 5 years didn't publish anything, and then came Portnoy's Complaint, 1969. It was the best-selling book of that year. Philip Roth has been publishing short novels. In 2009, The Humbling, 140 pages, the story of a famous stage actor in his mid-60s who suddenly finds that his talent is gone. His 31st book, Nemesis, came out in 2010. And it's the birthday of the Russian writer born in Ukraine, Nikolai Gogol, born 1809. His father owned a vodka distillery, had more than 300 serfs. Gogol went to college, then went off to St. Petersburg, ready to take on the world. He tried acting, but he failed at that, and then he tried writing short stories based in rural Ukraine, and his first book, Evenings on a Farm near Dekonka, was a big success. A few years later, the play The Government Inspector, a satirical play on Russian bureaucracy, but everybody liked it, including the Tsar. And it's the birthday of Richard Francis Burton, born in Torquay, England, 1821. He loved languages, learned Arabic at Oxford, and it was Burton who gave us the definitive English translation of the Arabian Nights, and then later the Kama Sutra. Here's a poem for today by James Wright, entitled March. A bear under the snow turns over to yawn. It's been a long, hard rest. Once as she lay asleep, her cubs fell out of her hair, and she did not know them. It is hard to breathe in a tight grave. So she roars, and the roof breaks. Dark rivers and leaves pour down. When the wind opens its doors in its own good time, the cubs follow that relaxed and beautiful woman outside to the unfamiliar cities of moss. March, a poem by James Wright from Above the River, the Collected Poems, published by Wesleyan University Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, now offering social campaigns, a new tool designed to help small businesses turn fans into customers. Learn more at ConstantContact.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Betsy Allister. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Tonight on 360 North, at 7 p.m., get news from around the country and the world from the BBC World News and weather across the state on Alaska Weather at 7:30. The documentary Alaska's Coolest Birds is at 8, followed at 8:55 by a World Ocean Day special on Alaska seabirds and the Coast Seabird Surveys. It's a great way to look at Alaska tonight on 360 North. Learn more and watch us at 360north.org.
Time is 3:17 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Tom Matisse, who is the emergency program preparedness kind of guy and also avalanche forecaster for the city and borough of Juneau, talking about a presentation tonight on the Urban Avalanche Mitigation Study. Tom, thank you very much for being in the station today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
So once again, your title, please.
It's Emergency Programs Manager and Avalanche Forecaster.
And a presentation tonight put on by the Swiss Institute for Snow and Avalanche Research.
Yeah, I'll be doing the presentation on a study we conducted with them last spring.
Tell me about it, please.
We had the Swiss Snow Institute come over and do an urban avalanche mitigation study to look at the possibilities of ways to mitigate the danger in the urban avalanche environment. We talked about fixed exploders, diversions and berms, removing houses, all kinds of different mitigation measures that would help reduce the risk in those environments.
What are some of the most commonly used mitigation measures?
Well, obviously, you know, you see Thane Road where they do active mitigation and then also passive mitigation, like there's a catchment dam on Thane Road. That's another kind of passive mitigation. And then also programs such as even buying out and relocating houses like they've done in Valdez and Cordova. So there's all kinds of things you can do to help mitigate the risk.
You're looking for public input tonight?
Most definitely. You know, we presented this study to the Assembly a few weeks back, and as an update to the city's all-hazards mitigation plan, we want to present it to the public and get their feedback to be able to answer questions so everybody understands what we're doing and where we're headed.
I imagine this all comes with a cost, but the cost is probably far less expensive if an avalanche really happens and we're not ready for it.
Most definitely. The study was actually conducted with FEMA grant funding, so it didn't cost the city anything, but we were able to get a grant to take care of it.
Avalanche-wise, how has this year been?
Oh, you know, we've had quite a few avalanches in the city. They've all been relatively small. We got to a heightened state of danger a couple times, and the avalanches kicked off before they got too big, which is a good thing, brought down some of the danger. We've actually still got a lot of the season left. We've got a lot of snow on the hill. Some of our bigger avalanche paths actually haven't released all the way from the summit, so the rest of the year is going to be interesting.
One of the big signs of spring is the avalanche coming down from the top of Mount Juneau, and you just hear this loud crashing sound, and then you see this snow flowing like a river.
Yeah, and it could happen at any time. You know, we've got a good month left for where it's going to snow up to that elevation, so hopefully we'll have lots of little storms instead of big ones.
What's the process of measuring snow like?
Well, you know, for avalanche studies, there's all kinds of things we do. We look at what's on the ground, the densities in the snow, the layering in the snow, how the snow is bonding to one another, crystal sizes, shapes, how those shapes add or subtract to their ability to hold on to each other. And we have remote weather stations as well as on-site analysis that we do and tests that we perform on the snow to be able to better understand those weak layers. And then we watch what Mother Nature brings us today, tomorrow, and next week and try to make educated decisions.
This all comes with the crystal ball that you use to predict the avalanches.
And there you go.
I wonder what happens to the howitzer leftovers that you shoot out into the hill on Juneau Mountain Roberts.
Oh, you know, on Thane Road there, the DOT uses a military howitzer that shoots an explosive round onto the hill, and it, when the round hits the hillside, that's what creates the boom. Is there's always one boom from the barrel and one boom on the side of the hill, and it blows up into little tiny fragments.
Tom Matisse talking about the Urban Avalanche Mitigation Study could be presented tonight at 7 o'clock in the Assembly Chambers. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No, we look forward to having the public out. We want people to understand the ways that we can mitigate the danger and what the findings were from the study, and we look forward to answering their questions so everybody understands.
Tom, thank you very much for coming down. Is there a website people can look at to get more information as well?
There is a link to it off of the Avalanche Forecast website. So if you go to juneau.org/avalanche, along the left side, there's a link that's direct to the Swiss study.
Tom, thank you very much for coming down. Anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
Oh, no, that's great, Jeff. Thanks so much for having me.
Programming support comes from the Southeast Alaska Sports and Recreation Show, offering everything from rock climbing to gardening, including seminars on outdoor activities at Centennial Hall this coming weekend.
Time is 3:24 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is Mandy O'Neill-Cole from AWARE. talk about this Wednesday's brown bag presentation at the Alaska State Museum at noon on homelessness and domestic violence. Mandy, thank you very much for being in the station today.
Thank you, Jeff.
So connect the dots if you could, please.
Sure. I think for many people, intuitively, you can recognize that homelessness and domestic violence are inextricably linked. There are so many factors that influence a person's homelessness. You can imagine that not being safe where they were living before is one of those logical events that might lead to a person being homeless. If you take into consideration all of the economic and power differential factors as well, you can see that finding a new place to live is also not something that is readily available for women who might be fleeing domestic violence. So we have a population of women who are afraid of their partners, who are caring for children, who may not have a lot of experience in the workforce, and who don't have all of the resources because they're fighting other battles in their lives. And so many of these women end up homeless. And so one of the things that AWARE does is partner and be participatory in the Juno Homeless Coalition so that we can kind of tell the story of women and women's unique experience of homelessness within the greater context of homelessness in Juno.
What about numbers locally and nationally?
Well, there was a study done by UAA last year that talked about the number of women in Juno who've experienced domestic violence. And that study found that 47 out of 100 women in Juno have experienced domestic violence in their lifetime. We at AWARE see about 600 women a year, women and children a year, for services. And of those 600, we shelter somewhere between 160 to 200 women and children each year. So you can imagine that this is not a small percentage of folks here in Juno, and that we are seeing a rise in the number of shelter nights that we provide to women and children. Over the last 10 years, I think we've gone from an average of about 4,000 to almost 6,000 shelter nights.
Is there a maximum of nights that people can stay at AWARE?
Well, there's a soft limit, I would say. Mm-hmm. We are funded to provide 30 days of emergency shelter. Given the climate in Juno, given the scarcity of housing available in Juno, we generally end up sheltering people for more than those 30 days. It is nearly impossible to leave your home and 30 days later be rehoused somewhere else. It is almost impossible in Juno.
And coming up with a security deposit and all sorts of other expenses.
Right. I mean, the economics of it are one thing. The real, you know, the real barrier is housing stock. We just don't have the housing stock in Juno that makes it possible to be rapidly rehoused.
What are the factors affect the problem?
Well, a lot of women and children who find themselves homeless have pets to worry about and take care of and make sure that they're safe. Children, extended family. We have women who are currently homeless now who have been homeless most of their lives and have experienced trauma in lots of different ways. Some are adult survivors of child sexual abuse. Some are victims currently of domestic violence and are in danger now. Some have are experiencing some disabilities that prevent them from being able to really access even the kind of inadequate, I would say, sometimes help that's there. You know, we as agencies in Juno do a lot for women and children and people experiencing homelessness, but you have to be able to access it. And that takes both a combination of knowing where the help is, being able to ask for the help, and having all of it line up such that there's housing available and there's help available at the same time. And I think sometimes that can be a real challenge for people going through crisis.
We'll be talking this noon at the Alaska State Museum on homelessness and domestic violence. What else are you going to be discussing?
Well, one of the main points of my talk is to kind of gather in the factors that disproportionately affect women and children who are homeless. And so I'm going to talk about domestic violence and sexual violence, but I'm also going to talk about childcare, transportation, employment, and poverty, and all of these things that women experience in a different way sometimes than men do. So a lot of my talk will be trying to help people see that there's no one-size-fits-all picture of domestic violence or of homelessness. And when you combine the two, which is often the case, you have a very complex family issue in front of you, and our solutions can't be the same for every person. So the elderly homeless veteran is not going to need the same kind of services as the young single mom who's fleeing violence. And so we have to continue to provide specialized supportive services, but more than anything, we have to get that housing stock built here in Juneau.
What are some of the things that happen when a woman calls up and says, I'm afraid of where I'm living now, and what can I do about it?
Right. AWARE's strength is in safety planning, because as counterintuitive as it may seem, sometimes just packing your bags and leaving right away is not the answer. And anyone who's experienced violence or intimate partner violence especially can attest to that, because it's really important to have a plan and to leave safely. Your number one concern when you're considering what to do when you're in danger is, how am I going to get myself and my kids safe? And sometimes that may mean staying where you are for a little bit longer while you put some supports in place, because certainly leaving one unsafe home to go to a life on the streets does not increase the safety for anybody, especially your children.
What do you do at AWARE then?
We do the safety planning. So we help people figure out what is available here in town. We provide that bridge emergency shelter, so if someone does have to leave in the middle of the night, or the police are called, or there's, for some reason, someone has to get out of the house right away, we have a shelter that's available and you can stay there. But more importantly, we have advocates who understand the complexities and can help you think through this process, this incredibly complex process of leaving. Because I think that most people assume that leaving will answer this problem, leaving is the solution, but leaving is just the beginning. Leaving has so many, brings up so many more questions than it answers, that is really helpful for women and for children to have educated, informed supports in place before they make a change like this.
Imagine it'd be difficult to find out how many people are actually couch surfing or using sleeping in their cars.
It's true. It is difficult. And, you know, my friend Scott Chamber can kind of tell you the differences about definitions in housing and homelessness. I'm kind of one of those people that say, you don't have a roof over your head. It sounds like you're homeless, right? But there are different definitions of homelessness. But we are interested in understanding how many people are couch surfing. And I would say that the majority, a lot of women who end up at AWARE have been staying with other people, trying to make it work. You know, maybe they left their partner, but they went to stay with their sister, and now there's a problem there. Or they went to stay with their mother, but then their sister had to move back in too, so there's not enough room for everybody. People come to AWARE not just in the heat of the crisis, but sometimes after those other strategies for keeping themselves safe haven't worked. So we like to really think about what are the possibilities for any person, and what is the end game here? And that's to be permanently, safely, and stably housed, which is a tall order.
We talked before on the show about the possible solutions for the problem of domestic violence.
Well, I still haven't gotten them, and I'm still not a millionaire yet. So I think one thing I can tell you is that the thing that I've experienced most in over 10 years of providing services to victims of domestic violence is that nobody knows how to keep you safe but you. I certainly have a lot of suggestions and have a kind of different perspective because I'm not in that situation. And I can help bounce ideas. I can help strategize. I can help inform. I can help educate. But truly, it is a humbling thing to learn in any job, I imagine, but especially in ours, that there is no right answer, and that women are endlessly creative and resourceful in how they're keeping themselves and their children safe. And sometimes all they need from you is a person to listen and connect with, and then they can come up with the answers on their own. And then sometimes we provide some more concrete assistance, you know, shelter or food. But as far as I know, the solutions for domestic violence is that people don't use violence to control their intimate partners. I'm still not quite sure how to get that happening. You know, we do have a program for men who use violence, an offender program, and the way that I really think about it is thinking about strategies that haven't worked in the past that have made you and your partner unhappy using violence and what you can do to replace those strategies and still get your needs met and her needs met. And I think, you know, that's pretty easily said and a lot more difficult to do, but I sure would like it if the work we did was impacting the safety and security for the people in Juneau, particularly women and children.
And later on this month, there's a Choose Respect March that is the governor's organizing.
Right. All right. I think that's a really great opportunity for all of us out there who maybe know a little, maybe don't know much, maybe know a lot about this issue to come out and say that Juneau should be a safe place for everyone, and that 47 out of 100 women experiencing violence in their lifetime is unacceptable. I mean, it's an outrageous number, and we need to, all of us who have well-meaning intentions and have a desire for our community to be stronger, need to come out and say that. It's unacceptable, and that means that we hold perpetrators accountable. You know, we hold them accountable in lots of ways. It's not just going to jail. Sometimes it's, you know, if your brother has been in trouble for domestic violence or a coworker, it's not just glossing over it or laughing when somebody makes a joke. It's really confronting what the issue is, and it's the safety of the people who are most dear to us. And so people taking that seriously, and also people taking seriously the voices of those who have been hurt and are in trauma and are in crisis. And that, you know, I think this is a way for all of us to do that and show some support for the people who we might not see overtly in our lives, but who are there. You know, that's the thing is, if you believe that this number is even close to true, 47 out of 100 women in Juneau, that means many of the women you see and interact with on a daily basis have been afraid of their intimate partner. And so what does that mean to you? Are you closing your eyes and not seeing it? Or are you opening your eyes and seeing the experience and being open to the experience of what's going on for the women in your life? And one of the ways you can show that you are open to talking and understanding is by participating in this march.
And we'll be talking to somebody about that later on a Juneau afternoon in the next few weeks. And you, Neil Cole from AWARE, you'll be giving a brown bag discussion on homelessness and domestic violence at the Alaska State Museum Wednesday at noon. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
That's right. The next week, the next Wednesday, Scott Chamber will be giving a talk. And Scott and I have kind of an informal contest on who's the better public speaker. So if you want to come to both of them, please feel free to sit in judgment of the two of us. And hopefully I'll come out on top. Thanks.
And thanks, Mandy.
is Bird Note, and this is the sound made by a river of birds. Imagine yourself in the stratosphere, looking down on North America. In spring and fall, you'll see what look like huge rivers of ducks, seabirds, shorebirds, raptors, and songbirds. Migrants, birds that raise their young in the same place year after year, but spend the rest of the year somewhere else, are moving along the four major North American flyways. In the spring, these rivers of birds flow north. At the end of the breeding season, the rivers flow south. After spending the winter in the southern tier of states, or Central America, or even as far away as South America, millions of birds return each spring to the northern latitudes. One of the world champions of long-distance migration is the Arctic tern. Arctic terns nest across the far northern reaches of the continent during our summer, then fly south to Antarctica for the rest of the year. Some will circle the polar ice pack before heading north again, completing a total round trip of up to 50,000 miles every year. You can see a map of this amazing migration begin at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
Time is 3:43 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Next guest here to talk about Celebration 2012, Liz Perry and Linda Blardy. Thank you very much for being in the station with me today.
Thank you very much for having us.
First of all, for people who do not know, what is Celebration?
Celebration is a three-day cultural event of dance and songs, and parades, artist market, juried art show, lectures, and various workshops. This is the, it started 30 years ago by Sea Alaska Heritage Foundation, and since we hold it every other year, this is our 15th celebration.
It's always an incredible event.
It is. It's really incredible.
We are expecting about 6,000 visitors this year, so our numbers keep going up with each celebration. So we'll have visitors from all over Southeast Alaska, and we're expecting about 50 or so dance groups to participate, as well as a number of artists in our expanded artist market.
Yeah, it's very hard to get in, so if you want, how do you get tickets?
Tickets are available at the door, and they will be available also at Sea Alaska Heritage Institute at the office. And if folks want to watch our website, which is SeaAlaskaHeritage.org, they can find a lot of information about Celebration as details are made and posted.
And they can also watch it on 360 North Television.
Yes, we have broadcast it on 360 North, and it is also recorded, and post-celebration DVDs would be available for folks who would like to purchase those.
What kind of things go on behind the scenes? How many volunteers and staff do you have?
Well, we are looking for 200 volunteers, and we need the volunteers to help us with the parade, which will be Saturday morning, with the grand entry, which is Thursday morning, with the elders' room. That's always a favorite. Lots of people like to volunteer for the elders' room. We have elder seating volunteers needed. Some security. A lot of that we take care of with paid security. We always need people to help clean up.
We also need people to be at the doors just to check for wristbands and make sure everybody has a paid admission, and just to make sure that elder seating is cleared out, the aisles are clear, those kinds of tasks as well. And we have just some general needs, too, people available to help us set up tables and chairs and just lend a hand wherever we need them. And our volunteers have previously been very flexible, and when they sign up, a lot of them just say, put me where you need me, and that's extremely helpful.
How long have you been planning for this event?
I think some initial planning started actually late last year. We had some initial meetings to kind of get the groundwork going. So by the time we get to celebration date, it will have been in the planning stages for about 6 months.
And actually, you know, right after celebration is over, we have a debriefing with all of the staff, and we have reports from all of the areas. And that's actually when the planning starts for the next time, because we say next time we better be careful about this area or that area. And then we kind of put it in hibernation until around January, I guess, we really go into full swing with planning.
And Pilardi, what makes the celebration special to you?
Well, you know, I've been out. I grew up here, but I left and was away for many, many years. So my first celebration was 2002. And my aunt, Catherine Mills, was one of the founding dance group members. You know, the first dance group, the first celebration had 12 dance groups. And Catherine Mills, my aunt, was from the Huna group. And she used to talk about it when I would come home during the summers. But I never, ever was able to come. And then in 2002, that was my first one. And it was the year I was retiring from my job down south. And I thought, I'm going to go up and just see what this celebration is all about. And there's so many people. People save their money, and not only dance group people, but just people who grew up in Southeast Alaska who know this is a time. It's kind of like gold medal for the non-basketball players, so that people come and they see their relatives, they see their friends, and for me that's really nice.
Liz, how about you?
Well, I had the opportunity to participate in my very first celebration in 2010, and I was coordinating volunteers then. And I was really fascinated and amazed at the people who came in and were really respectful and interested and participated in their own way with all of the dance performances and the enthusiasm for all of the performances and the art shows. All of it. Everyone was extremely enthusiastic and appreciative for the hard work, actually, that we had put into it. That was very gratifying.
And then, Linda, do you have a favorite part?
Do I have a favorite part? You know, something that this will be our third year that we're doing is the soapberry contest. And it was we've done a seaweed contest for four celebrations, and then after we did that, one of our staff employees suggested that we do a soapberry contest. And soapberries are unique to certain parts of Alaska and Canada, and not too many people have soapberries now. So it's kind of it's just a fun thing because it's open. To anybody who wants to participate, the rules are they must have gathered the soapberries themselves, and then they can prepare it in whatever way they want. And then we have judges who are doing taste tests, and they test it on flavor, they test it on consistency. And that part, for me, was really fun. I've been in charge of that before, and I will be again this time.
What does a soapberry taste like? Does it taste like soap?
No, it doesn't taste like soap, but it looks like soap because it's kind of sudsy, and they're quite tart. So most people, when I was a kid, we had them with sugar and sliced bananas, and there's kind of a trick, well, not a trick, but there's a technique to eating them, so you kind of slurp them around in your mouth, and it's fun. It's a fun part of celebration.
My favorite part is the parade because you could just see an amazing mass of people so excited to be here celebrating the culture. So you're looking for volunteers again? And
we are. As Linda mentioned, we're looking for up to about 200 volunteers, and I am coordinating that effort for this year's celebration. Actually, we are having an informational meeting this evening at Centennial Hall between 5 and 6 p.m., and anyone who is interested in volunteering for this year's celebration can attend that meeting. We'll have registration forms and some general information for folks, get things outlined for them. If you can't attend the meeting, that's not a problem. We will have another meeting April 4th and another meeting May 9th. All of those are at between 5 and 6 p.m. and it's at Centennial, or they can call me directly at 586-9264 if they would like more information on volunteering or if they need a registration form.
And celebration itself is when?
June 7th through 9th.
All right.
And, Jeff, we want to make sure everybody knows that it's open. This isn't a closed event. We invite the citizens of Juneau to come get a three-day pass or a one-day pass and just see what all the excitement is all about.
Yeah, we are really wanting the folks here in Juneau and in the other communities who would just like to see what celebration is. And we really want to push the fact that it is a community-wide event and everyone is welcome.
And a phone number again?
Phone number to volunteer is 586-9264.
And a website again, more information about the celebration?
Website is sealaskaheritage.org.
All right, Liz Perry and Linda Bilardi, anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
We hope to see all of Juneau there. We're working hard to get a great event, and we've got people lined up. A couple of deadlines we'd like to remind folks about for the Jury Arts Show. Deadline to apply for that is the 21st of March. Deadline for the Native Artist Market application is the 30th of March, and the Toddler Regalia Review applications are due on May 4th. So if folks could get those in, we'd really appreciate it.
All right, Liz Perry and Linda Bilardi, thank you so much for coming down to the station today and talking about Celebration 2012. Promises to be a great event. When are tickets going on sale again?
Tickets will probably be on sale probably mid-May. And again, they'll watch the website. All of that information will be posted there.
All right, thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Folk Festival is near, and it's time to get in the spirit and polish those dance moves at the Barn Dance. Saturday, March 24th, 7:30 at St. Anne's Parish Hall, downtown on 5th and Gold. Odette Edgar will teach and call contra dances to live French, Canadian, and Celtic music by the Bevels and Church, featuring Kathy Fanning, Sally Donaldson, Nene Wolf, Wendy Parker, and John Church. As always, no experience or partners are necessary. Free for Saga, JVs, and under 13. Good music, good dancing, good times at the Barn Dance this Saturday.
The Juneau World Affairs Council presents T.R. Reid this Wednesday, March 21st, beginning at 5 p.m. at the UAS Library. His topic is his new PBS film, U.S. Healthcare, The Good News. Reid travels the country to find high-quality healthcare at costs way below the national average. This event is made possible with support from GCI, Greens Creek, Sea Alaska, Kensington, and Wassman & Associates. That's this Wednesday, March 21st, at 5 p.m. at the UAS Library. Admission is free. More details at jwac.org.
Diwan matin amdawa wadaw na hasma dede enta stena manta dawun tu yam tiklam
diwan matin amdawa wadaw na hasma.
358, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTUO also broadcast on these translators. In the Valley and Ockham area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT Sursuna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTUO on K210 AS 89.9, also live online at www.ktuo.org. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock on a Juneau afternoon, Pat Moore will be your host. He'll talk with Mike Hutchinson from the Juneau Job Center about Wednesday's job fair. Kathleen McCurran from the Center for Nonviolent Communication will be talking about this weekend's workshops. And Pat will also be talking to artist David Rosenthal about a show of paintings at the Alaska State Museum. At Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon. With the forecast today, it looks like there's a strong wind expected through this evening through Tuesday afternoon. Partly cloudy skies expected for the rest of today with low temperatures 18 to 27 degrees, northeast winds 10 to 15 miles per hour near downtown Juneau and Douglas. Gusts of 55 miles per hour mainly after midnight tonight. Forecast for Tuesday, it looks like locally windy weather and increasing clouds, high temperatures around 37 degrees. Tuesday night, cloudy skies, low temperatures around 27 degrees. We have next is All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to June afternoon. Have a pleasant evening.